name is Dr. Bensian Sirotskin. I'm a clinical psychologist. And I want to begin by thanking Rabbi Kramer for giving me this opportunity, because I think, you know, anybody who works in the field of education, of chinuch, knows how important it is that all the people involved in a child's life be working together and being on the same page and pulling in the same direction. So, okay, therefore, having this opportunity that we can talk a little bit about the whole experience of therapy and what's it like for a child to go to therapy, I think would be beneficial to both therapists and educators. It's especially important because very frequently it is teachers who are the first ones who notice that a child is suffering from emotional distress. And it's very often, especially with younger children or school-age children, it's very often the ones who first come up with the idea that perhaps the child could benefit from therapy is very often the teachers. Unfortunately, very often the teachers really don't have that much of an idea what therapy is all about. Unless they personally experienced it, they very often really, they know there's such a thing, but they don't have like a clarity exactly what it is, because there's a bit of mystique around the whole issue. That's probably where the whole idea of a shrink came from. Since nobody knows exactly what it is, so they call it a shrink, just to be on the safe side. So I would like tonight to a little bit demystify what the whole process is really all about, what actually gets shrunk, right? And what is it that brings children to therapy, what actually goes on in therapy, and how it's supposed to help. You know, in a certain sense, it's difficult to generalize. It would be like asking a room full of teachers, you know, what teaching is exactly. You know, probably get as many answers as there are teachers. And certainly with therapists, that would be true. You probably would get more answers than there are therapists. Each one has their own perspective of exactly what it is. Each one has a theory. Each one has their own school of thought. But nonetheless, there's a certain common denominator. Just like probably if you take a few good teachers, there's probably more in common with them, even if they have different approaches, than there are differences. And that is true also of effective therapy. There's been much research on the common factors, as they call it, in therapy. What is it that good therapists do? What I'll be telling you is, of course, you'll be seeing it through the prism of my personal look, the way I do therapy or the way I understand it. But nonetheless, I hope it will give you some idea of what usually goes on. You can feel free to ask questions to clarify what I'm saying. If you have any questions about what I'm saying, feel free to ask. Many of the things that I'll be discussing tonight are things that I've written about in the articles I've had published in different places, and if they're available on my website, which is drsirotskin.com, and there's articles I've written and speeches I've gave, audio files, I think they call them. I don't know how to do it, but they're there, and there's instructions how to do it. Also, I have some handouts. A lot of what I'm going to be speaking today, I had written three articles in the Nefesh News that relate to some of the things we talk about. I have your handouts afterwards. You can look at it. So let's begin with what usually brings a child to therapy, right? So, first of all, there are what we call developmental problems. You usually have kids who come with either learning disabilities, ADD, although nobody's actually ever discovered exactly what the developmental problem is, but it's hypothesized that these are developmental problems, either areas of the brain that didn't develop or immature. Then they have emotional problems, which broadly defined includes acting out, you know, children who are aggressive. There's acting in, as we call it, you know, like depression or the various anxiety disorders like extreme shyness, phobias, obsessive-compulsive disorders, panic disorders. It's very important, though, to point out, and I think even very often therapists, I think, miss this point, that very often emotional disorders can masquerade as developmental disorders. Somebody recently wrote an article, a wonderful article, I think I referenced it in this handout, pleading with clinicians not to diagnose children with ADD before you rule out emotional disorders. Very often, what they call attachment disorders, but when a child is very emotionally distressed, it wouldn't be surprising if it would cause them to have a difficulty concentrating, or if it would cause them difficulty remembering, and various other learning problems. And very often, in today's day and age especially, since it's very popular to look at things from a biological perspective, very often when children come I've had it myself when I've referred myself, don't treat young children, but I've referred sometimes the children of patients to other therapists where there's clearly tremendous emotional upheavals and difficulties in the family, and the first thing the therapist sees there's a problem, and he decides, you know, there's something, a developmental disorder, a biological disorder. It's interesting to note that the Teferis Yisrael in Pekavis, where he talks about, where we discuss this in Perek Vav, the Menches Dvarim Shatar Niknes Bahem, it twice mentions Simcha. One is the Simcha and one is Samech B'Chalkai. And the Teferis Yisrael explains the reason why Simcha, why happiness is so important to be acquired Torah knowledge, is because he says, the Lashon he says is that Ein Lecha Dover HaMeinea Shkeit Zikaron V'Avone K'may Atzus V'Adaga. There's nothing that prevents a person's ability to think clearly, to understand, and to remember, like being sad or worried. So very often, you know, when a child is not functioning, when he's even cognitively, when he's not functioning the way he should be, one should look to see if there is any emotional cause for his disorder. When children, especially when children are sent for evaluations, you know, you always get a diagnosis. Maybe many are you familiar with the psychiatric Bible, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's a very thick book with a million diagnoses, which in the earlier days, they're holding, I think, by the fourth edition, now they're working on the fifth. In the earlier editions, the DSM was really based on theories, our theoretical understanding of what the underlying cause of the problem is. As the community has gotten more scientific, so to speak, the later editions are much more just based on the symptoms, without any understanding of what the underlying cause is, and there just has been a tremendous proliferation of diagnoses. There's been a tremendous emphasis in recent years on what hypothesized genetic causes for disorders, chemical imbalances. Many times when people come to a doctor today with some sort of emotional problem, they tell me he has a chemical imbalance. I think there's a tremendous amount of distortion and misunderstanding in this. I think it's important to know this. Again, I discuss it at length in this handout. But there's a very popular book in the Frum community written by a well-known Frum clinician who's made the statement, and he writes in his book, that the fact that psychiatric medication can often help alleviate emotional disorders is conclusive evidence the original cause of the problem is purely chemical. And looking for psychological causes is not only not useful, it can even be harmful. I can only say I think he's categorically wrong, and I think the evidence is very clear, and again, I discussed it at length. You know, with all due respect, he's a very respected clinician, but I think in this, he's wrong. And the example I always think of is, you know, I have a friend who's a tax accountant, and as you can imagine, every April 15th he has a splitting headache. He probably, you know, hasn't slept in a month. And if he takes Tylenol, it alleviates the symptom. I don't think anybody would therefore see this as conclusive evidence that the original cause of his headache was a mysterious depletion of Tylenol in his brain. Yes? Right. Now, okay, yes, I'm just giving you an example, but who knows, when a person has ongoing problems, or even it could be a specific event or ongoing problem, the brain works through chemicals, everything. When you hear a joke, if you had the proper equipment, you could see how the chemical reaction to the joke that makes you laugh. And if one day they'll discover a medication that could either cut off that chemical message and stop you from laughing, or maybe actually work the reverse and make you laugh, which I guess comedians would love. So the fact that anything that happens to a person is mediated through chemicals, and therefore you can intervene chemically. So it's certainly true that if a person is very stressed out or very distressed in his life or very unhappy, it could create a certain chemical metzias in his brain. And I myself refer for medication sometimes. Sometimes that is the best way to treat it, or, you know, to help the therapy go quicker. But the mistake is to assume that that is the original cause of the problem. It's a reaction to the cause. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Would be a good example. On a regular basis.
Right.
April 15th would be every 2 months.
Right. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
What you're saying is that intervening chemically is really just an artificial means of explaining what ultimately needs to be accomplished by psychological correction.
Yes, they've actually shown this, because today they have, with the sophisticated equipment they have with brain imaging, they've shown that the effect of psychotherapy without medication and the effect of medication without psychotherapy is identical in the brain. And the only difference is that the medication works quicker, but psychotherapy lasts longer, because medication without therapy, as soon as you stop the medication, it goes back to the original the way it was originally. But right, they've shown that actually in brain imaging. Now, many people have criticized, many researchers have criticized the proliferation of diagnoses because it doesn't really add anything. You know, you could have 15 different subcategories of depression. The differences aren't all that great. And some have recommended more general terms that really sort of explains more what it is that's the emotional experience that the person is going through. For instance, recently somebody suggested using the term affect phobia. Affect is feelings, and phobia, you know, because the emotional experience of many people who come to therapy is they can't deal with their feelings. They can't accept their feelings, they can't identify their feelings, they can't express their feelings. That includes many types of anxiety and depressive disorders, and using such a term would be more explanatory than just coming with some fancy term that doesn't really explain anything. It's like, you know, when a teacher has a kid who can't sit still in class and constantly jumping out of the seat and so on, and you send them to the therapist and they spend a lot of money and make all kinds of studies on the kid and spend much time, and then they tell you he's hyperactive. Shkayach is just another name for what you knew. It doesn't purport to explain anything. It's a descriptive term. The DSM today is very much more descriptive than explanatory. And calling something saying that a person is suffering from affect phobia is more explanatory. It explains that he can't deal with his feelings. But beyond all the question of symptoms and diagnosis, what is the emotional experience of most children who come to therapy? So I will emphasize the role of parents in this issue, and the reason for that is, and I'll quote Rav Noach Erlewick. I'm sure most of you heard of him, the Mashgiach in Yerushalayim. He's written many books on chinuch. He recently said it at a Agudas Yisrael conference, and it was quoted in the Jewish Observer. He said, "No single factor is as important to a child's development as the influence of his or her parents. Which, you know, shouldn't be very shocking, since the child's psyche develops at a young age, and the people who are most important in his or her life at that age is the parents. So it's not surprising that it has a tremendous effect. It's important to realize that very often the current difficulties you see in a child when he comes to your attention as suffering from some emotional difficulties very often is certainly caused a great deal by the caretakers, most often the parents' reaction to his original problem more than the original problem itself. For example, if a child has had some sort of minor learning disability, right? That is a problem. It could be a serious problem. But the way it's dealt with and the way that, say, the parents react to the problem is very often a bigger factor in the eventual problem than the original problem itself. If the parents are supportive and are not critical and try to get the child the help he needs, then, of course, it won't become a major problem. If, on the contrary, if they're very critical, then, of course, you'll have a grow into a much larger problem. In fact, I just reminded myself right now, quite a few years ago, a young man was brought to me who, I think at that time he was finishing eighth grade, and the short version of the story is that he had always had tremendous problems in school, and the parents were teachers, it happens to be, were told by the school that they should get the child evaluated for ADD, and they refused for year after year after year, and finally by the time he got to eighth grade, and they pressured the child. They told him it's because he's lazy and because he doesn't try, because he doesn't care. And this went on until he got to eighth grade, and then the school put their foot down. They had it in a high school. The school had a high school. They said, listen, they're not accepting him in high school unless they get him evaluated. They got him evaluated. The evaluator said he clearly has ADD. They put him on Ritalin. He went within 2 weeks from getting like 40s to getting 90s. So this went on for 2 weeks, and then the kid said he's not taking it anymore. That's when I saw him. And basically what he told me when I asked him, like, you know, you see how much it helps you, why don't you want to take it? He says, listen, my whole life they're telling me that the reason why I'm not doing well is because I'm lazy and I don't care. All of a sudden they give me this magic pill and suddenly I'm supposed to take it, he said, over my dead body. And that's it, you couldn't talk him out of it. I don't even know what happened to him eventually, but there's no way I could convince him otherwise. I must tell you the truth, I sympathized with him. You know, sometimes you do have to cut off your nose to spite your face. Somebody actually wrote an article with that name. More recently I saw somebody who originally had a kriya problem. He's right now in Masifta, and he told me that his father was given the job to help him with kriya. very sad mistake, because the father is absolutely not an ounce of patience. There's absolutely no shalom bayis in the house, never was. In fact, I speculate that's probably the original cause of his loneliness, of his kriya problem. And it was like a horrible experience. He told me it's like the worst thing you can imagine, how terrible it was. Okay, so that made him very embarrassed about his kriya problem. To this day, like, he doesn't feel like he can be open with the Rebbe and tell him that he has a kriya problem. And certainly the way he was reacted to, in fact, it even caused a problem with the Rebbe, because the Rebbe doesn't know, and he asked him to read, and he didn't read so well. And the Rebbe, who he likes, you know, good-naturedly kidded him about it, which, you know, wasn't what he needed to hear. But this is more a reaction to the reaction to his kriya problem than the original kriya problem. Yes.
How can a school or a psychologist deal with a lack of shalom bayis now?
Excellent question.
If everyone finds that, when it all comes down to
it, shalom bayis,
how do you think that you can?
I'll tell you what it is. Excellent. You know, obviously, if you convince the parents to go for marriage counseling, that'll be helpful. But I'll tell you what it is. What could be done? First of all, recently I dealt with a young man who had never did well in school, and it caused tremendous conflict between him and his father. I'm mentioning him soon, but his father was mamish raged with him terribly because of how he did. The shalom bayis there was beyond horrible, and when I had actually met the parents before I met the young man, they didn't mention a word about that. They just told me what a lazy kid he is, and he doesn't do any work, and he doesn't care, etc., etc. After I spoke to the young man and I found out about this, I had met with them again. And I said to him, you know, did you ever consider... I asked them, you know, I understand that there was marital issues in your life. Yeah, there is. They're working now, it's better. They've been in counseling, okay. I said, in his formative years when he was in school, it was terrible, right? Yeah, okay, it was. Do you think that may have had something to do with why he didn't do well in school? I mean, you know, do you expect him when he comes from school and they're screaming in the house, you know, until he, you know, for an hour until he goes to school, you should go to school and sit there and listen to the teachers if everything's okay in his life? So I accomplished two things. First of all, the young man himself understood himself better, which we'll discuss soon. And at least let's be honest about what the problem is. Because this kid has been going on for years and years and years, and told the reason why he's not doing well in school, the only reason is because he's lazy and he doesn't care.
Like you said, it just happens later on. How do you convince a fifth grader or a fourth grader? How do you find out about it?
Well, then you have to work with the parents. Obviously, with very young children, then you know, in some schools... You have to know, I'll tell you, the one reason why very often therapists or teachers don't find out, because we very often either focus on the symptoms or believe that it's likely, like these parents believe, that the kid doesn't care that he's not doing well. Right, I think I know. I have yet to meet a child or a youngster or a teenager who doesn't care that he's failing in school. Eventually, could be at a certain point after years of failing. Eventually, they don't care anymore as a defense mechanism. I think we would ask more questions, right? You know, if we would understand that most people don't enjoy failing. You know, we use expressions like he's doing it to himself, as if, you know, yeah, sure. Like, why should I succeed? I could just as well fail. Okay. Very often the reason why the caretakers are not dealing with it properly is not because of a lack of skills. You know, it's a chesaron in yediyah. That's usually not. Usually what the problem is, they're dealing with their own issues. I once worked with a fellow who happened to be a dorm counselor in the yeshiva, and he himself grew up with a step-parent who he had a horrible relationship with, and he had a lot of conflict with his charges. You know, getting them to sleep on time and getting them up on time in the morning. And at one point it started bothering him terribly what a disharmonious relationship he had with them. So when I discussed with him, you know, he was clearly overreacting. You know, they didn't go to sleep exactly on time and didn't get up exactly on time. So so first he asked me for advice, like techniques. Like, I said, I don't know, before we deal with techniques, let's understand what you're experiencing. Right? So I got him to think about it, to introspect a little bit. Like, what does he feel like when the bachrim, you know, aren't going to sleep on time? And basically, what he told me is because, you know, he has very poor self-esteem, and therefore, if the bachrim, he feels it reflects on him. If he doesn't get the bachrim to go to sleep exactly on time, he looks bad. Or if they don't wake up on time, right? And that's, he was reacting to that emotional feeling. You know, it was him, not the bachrim. And that's why he reacted that way. And when I helped him understand that, you know, he's just recreating his step-parent relationship to him, And that actually, if they went to sleep 10, 15, 20 minutes, even a half an hour later than curfew, but if they went to sleep happy and he had a decent relationship with them, everybody would be happier with him. Which took him a while to internalize, but when he did it, it did have a dramatic impact on his relationship with the boys. Now, very often, part of the problem is that very often the parents, and it's true of educators too, very often misattribute negative and malicious motivation to children's difficulties. And you can tell this as teacher. When you speak to a parent of a child maybe who's having a behavior difficulties, if you pay attention to the languages used, I think very often it's an eye-opener and you get a picture to what's going on. Some parents, at least in therapy, it's not the right, you know, will come in, you know, he's a wonderful kid, I don't know, he's obviously having a problem with this particular issue, I really don't understand why, maybe you could figure out from him, maybe it's something that I'm doing, you can tell me. In fact, in one rare event, we reminded the one woman came to discuss a problem with her son, and I asked her, why do you think he has this problem? So she tells me, I don't know, the pediatrician told me maybe he has a chemical imbalance. What do you think? I said, well, you know, I'm not so sure, you know, there's other factors based on what you told me. So she realized I was being, you know, not wanting to be too critical, so she stopped me in the nose and goes, doctor, you don't understand. I'm hoping you'll say it's my fault, because then there's something I can do about it. I can correct it. You tell me it's a chemical imbalance. What should I do? Unfortunately, that's not usually what happens. And very often what you hear from parents, they use a very pejorative term. Child's lazy, which is the most popular one. I have a survey of the most popular terms. Lazy is the number one explanation. Number two one is manipulative. Selfish is somewhere at three or four, right? And you understand that this is the perspective, this is the parent's understanding of the child's problem. That, of course, has a tremendous impact on the interaction between the parent and the child. Yes?
Can you say that it's more popular
with the boy than lazy? I'll tell you, let me give you a marshal for that, to answer that question. Let's say if you were standing on the subway waiting for a train, and the train is late, as they usually are, right? And you see somebody like leaning over to see if the train is coming, he falls on the tracks, right? And all of a sudden you hear the rumble of the approaching train, and the person isn't moving, he's sitting there, right? And somebody says to you, I wonder why this guy isn't moving, the train is getting close. And you'll say, you know what, he's probably lazy. Would that be a reasonable explanation? Right? It's much more likely he got hurt, he's traumatized, right? He's in shock. Right? You know, laziness, when it affects you, you know, or if somebody was standing near a fire, was getting closer and closer, and it's trying to singe him, and he's not moving, would you think laziness is a likely explanation? You know when laziness makes sense? Let's say if there's a kid, he has a test. And, you know, he does pretty well in school, but, you know, he'd rather do something else than study for a test. He'd rather play ball. And he has an opportunity to steal the test. What's that guy? It's a horror of laziness, you know. Instead of studying, steal the test. But somebody who's failing year after year after year, is laziness a reasonable explanation? Even the HR has to make sense. Yes?
Comparing succeeding in school,
succeeding
in learning,
yeah. Well, it depends how much. If you tell me somebody's getting an 80 instead of a 90 and, you know, he's too lazy to work harder, that's also possible.
He's getting a failing mark.
You met somebody like that? Introduce me, please. Now, it's usually a person that's either depressed, has no faith in his own, he doesn't believe that he could be successful. Think about it. Like, I'll give you some examples. You'll see where laziness has been. Wait a minute, I'll get to that point, okay? You know, somebody once did an unbelievable study. A guy named Strasberg once did a tremendous study. He took two groups of mothers. They always pick on the mother psychologist, but he had two groups of mothers, right? And he had one group of mothers who had no particular problems with their children, and one group of mothers who had tremendous problems with their children. You know, behavior problems and other things. And what they did, what Strasberg did, he showed them video clips. Video clips. What was the video clips? Of a childhood behavior. So let's say an example of a video clip was a short clip of a child playing with his toys, and the mother suddenly says, Johnny, put away your toys, you have to go to sleep. And Johnny says, oh, come on, Mommy, let me play for another few minutes, I'm in the middle of a game. That's a whole video clip. And the task the mothers had was to write a brief description of what they saw. That's it. And the difference between the two groups was startling. The mothers who didn't have particular problems described this as a normal event. There's a kid in the middle of a game, doesn't want to go to sleep. The other mothers wrote things like, this is a child who's manipulative, he's trying to, you know, overthrow his mother's authority, b'chulu b'chulu, right? And you could understand that obviously the reactions the mothers have so it's not a problem with a skill. It's not that she doesn't have, you know, parenting skills, and that's one of the reasons why parenting skill classes are not that successful, if you don't deal with the underlying perception of what you see. Right? This reminds me of the verse from Chaim Shmulevitz. He talks about the Meraglim and why they were punished for 40 years in the Midbar, because it was 1 year for each year, 1 year for each day they were went through Eretz Yisrael. The Meraglim went through the Eretz Yisrael for 40 days. So he asked the Kasher, what do you mean? They didn't do anything wrong for 40 days. There it was, when they said Lashon Hara and Eretz Yisrael. He said, yeah, the reason why they said Lashon Hara is because they saw everything behind Ra. The problem is with the 40 days, the problem is not what they said, the problem is what they saw. Right? And this is also very often the case here, is how you perceive the problem will affect how you react. I'll give you an example. This happened recently. I was speaking to the parents of a young man who was pretty much now doing nothing. Dropped out of yeshiva. There's a lot of problems there. The Rebbe who asked me to see this bacher told me that there's tremendous problems. All kinds of problems there, but that's not the point for the moment. But the mother was telling me, the mother who's more sympathetic and understanding of the son than the father, the mother told me that the reason, one of the reasons he can't get a job is because he has so little self-esteem and so little confidence, and he's so obsessed with what people think about him that he can't go and look for a job. And he's very self-conscious. The father turns and says, self-conscious? That's ridiculous. Totally not the reason. He's just plain lazy. What's the proof? Because one time, a little while ago, there was an accident in front of the house, and there were a few policemen there, and he walked over to one of the policemen and spoke to the policeman. Well, that's a clear idea that he's not self-conscious. He was self-conscious. He went up to speak to the policeman. The male means he's lazy, and the whole reason is because he doesn't feel like working. Now, all right? Now, you can understand that the mother and the father have a very different relationship with this boy, because they have a totally different perspective of what his problem. Another common example of this you see very often in this time of the year, you know, during the camp season. You know, a kid goes to camp for the first time, he cries, calls every day, he's crying, he's miserable. Parents don't know exactly what to do. So they ask somebody who's in the area, somebody has a bungalow colony near the area, or somebody, a cousin who works in the camp, you know, go see what's going on with my son. They call back and say, I don't know, he seems to be perfectly happy. I saw him, he was in the middle of a game, and he's a mom, and she's playing, and he seems to be fine. Okay, so the kid's lying. Right? This is amazing. This is a good thing about laziness. I mean, it's a different version of this. Right? Really, the kid is extremely happy. He's having a blast. But I guess because he has nothing to do, he calls all the time. He calls home and cries that he's miserable. That's the theory. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but that's such a theory. Right? Now, I guess a lot of people can't understand that even when you're miserable, you can sometimes distract yourself by doing something you enjoy. It has nothing to do with being, you know, maybe he's very homesick, but he doesn't feel it when he distracts himself and playing. So the parents, when a parent reacts to the child, not with reassurance or whatever it is, but just tells, you know, gives them the impression that they think he's lying, he's making the whole thing up, that will have an impact on the relationship with the child or how they deal with it. Now, their general misguided theories that very often fuel this problem. I'll give you an example. In fact, I want to ask the people here what you think about this conversation I had. A few years ago, I got a call from a lady from a different city. She wanted a phone consult. She told me she has a 16-year-old son who dropped out of yeshiva. He's working somewhere in a store. And her main area of concern was that she wasn't happy the way he was dressing, the music he was listening to, the kids he was hanging around with, and those type of things. And, you know, she wanted advice how to deal with it. But she had one piece of good news. The piece of good news was that she got him to learn every day for an hour with a chavrusa. How did you do that? It's very simple. He's dying to take driver's ed, and I told him he can only take driver's ed if he learns every day with a chavrusa. Okay? I don't know what people think about this idea. That, you know, was this an accomplishment? Nachshon Ben Aminadav. Yes?
I think that it's definitely temporary.
Yes.
Recognizing
what? Okay.
And it depends on the child. Child will have a child that feels guaranteed, but if not, you know, maybe do anything without that, then he has to push him forward to a situation where this will actually have to do something positive. But you have to know your child, obviously, and if the child is going to use it as a crutch to actually get away with things,
how is that 16?
Sometimes the drop is that to give him self-confidence.
Yeah. I'll talk about the learning part.
The learning.
Yeah, you know, about, again, using that as a way to get him to learn. Yes. Go ahead, yeah.
I'm teaching a child.
Well, you're teaching how wonderful driver's ed is. Yeah.
Think for teenagers.
Okay, yeah.
What's the difference between rewarding a teenager, 16 years old, and rewarding a 10-year-old kid by saying, I'll give you an ice cream.
Okay. All right, so let me relate to what all of you are saying. Part of the reason some people think it's a good idea, a little bit related to what you just said now, is most people believe that the concept of Chazal, the Matay Sholei Lishma Bo Lishma, is a law of nature that works somewhat like the law of gravity. You know, if you leave go of something, it's going to drop to the floor. And if you get a child to do something, it doesn't matter how you get him to do it. You can hold a shotgun to his head and get him to do it. Eventually, he's going to do it for the right reason. Again, why people believe this, I find a bit amazing, because everybody knows there's countless of kids who learned very well for a year or two sometime in their life when they stopped learning, or other such things. But somehow there is a belief, this is a general theory that people have that affects their interaction with kids, is that no matter how you get somebody to do something, if he does it, as long as he's doing the right thing, then it's good. In fact, one mother recently told me that her son is 21 years old. When he goes home on vacation, which he usually tries to avoid, but Pesach and Sukkah is kind of difficult, when he goes home, she drives him crazy to get him out of bed in the morning. She fights with him every morning. He usually doesn't get up anyway, but she fights. And when I discussed it with her, she said, I made a conscious decision that I'd rather he be angry with me as long as he gets the davening. Based on the same theory, as long as he's doing the right thing. So, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because the reason why a person does it, and I was like this, even let's say if theoretically, let's say if a child learned what Sonny mentioned, if he's learning with the right person. In theory, that's right. Now, if you can convince him to do it, and he learns with the right person, that could very well have that effect, you know, it might get him out. But the fact that he's being forced, he's actually being blackmailed, I've never seen anybody enjoy doing something when they were blackmailed to do it. Yes?
There's a fine line in these cases. Yeah. In one case, there's going to be an incentive. The other case, the woman's screaming, get out of bed, go to davening.
Yes.
At least still daven.
But he didn't experience it as an incentive, you understand? Because he was basically told, the shoemaker didn't want to do it. And his mother said, listen, Charlie.
Well, he
didn't want to do it. No, he wanted to just take driver's ed. I knew there was something wrong with his story, because from what you told me about the other things he was doing, it didn't sound like he wanted to go learn.
So an incentive.
So let me tell you that Rabbi Matisyahu Salman has a shmooze that actually was printed in the Jewish Observer, although I heard the actual shmooze and they didn't really understand it, the one who wrote it. I guess he doesn't check things over before they publish it. But basically what he says is that the point of the point of giving a reward, it's based on a very interesting Zayar that we won't get into, but it says that the point of giving a reward is not an incentive. That is not the point. Because really, when you give an incentive, these studies have shown that the bigger the incentive, and many of these programs, you know, with Mishnayos and Baal Peh and all these things, they pride themselves how much money they spend on prizes. You know, when they put out their brochures trying to raise money, they brag, we spend $1 million on prizes, because you'd be massive. Right? And the point is, what you're teaching somebody is the value of prizes, or tchotchkes, whatever you give them. You know, this tchotchke is so worth it that kedai to learn for an hour to get the tchotchke. How wonderful it is. And basically what the Rav Dessler, if you see it, he's in many places when he discusses the Indian of Leili Shema, he talks that Leili Shema is a poison. It's like Rahman Latsan, somebody that needs chemotherapy. Doctor knows it's poison. Sometimes you have to give a little poison, but you give the least amount possible, you try to get them off as quickly as possible. Right? The Leili Shema is the mice of poison. It's the hepech of what you're trying to accomplish. Sometimes you need a little bit, but since people think it automatically becomes a Shema, the more the Leili Shema, the better. There's no reason to try to the pshat, oh, I forgot, I didn't finish what I said from Rav Matisyahu, that the pshat of giving a prize is to make the kid happy, so that he associates happiness with what he's doing. That's how the whole idea of the candy man and shul started, that going to shul should be associated with something positive. Somehow the originators of this minhag didn't realize that the father was going to be yelling the kid to daven, smacking him up a few times, embarrassing him in public, which counteracts, I think, the candy. But he said it's not an incentive. And the nafkamid al-halacha, he says, is that if you're using it as an incentive, so you try to hold off giving the incentive as long as possible, you get the most miles for your buck. But when you realize you're trying to make him happy, he says, try to give it to him as soon as possible. Right? So, in Hanami, there's big problems with incentives. If you look, there's a tremendous amount of research in social psychology on cognitive dissonance, and the numbers show that the bigger the prize, the less likely the person will develop an intrinsic motivation. Think, is you ready? Yeah. Give an incentive? I've just said to kids, I don't want to get this a little bit off our field, but I say that the way to use it is like this. The only time it works is if the child wants it. Let's say a child himself is not happy, he's not doing well in school. And the bother, you know, and part of the reason is because he doesn't do his homework. He doesn't enjoy doing his homework. He'd rather play. So you can tell the child, listen, I feel bad for you. I see that you're very frustrated. You know, and part of the reason why you're not doing well is because you don't do, you know, your homework, which I perfectly understand, because after spending hours in school, that's not what you want to do. Would it make it easier for you if I gave you, every time you did it, I gave you a prize or whatever, would that make it easier for you? So then he's a shittif to the plan rather than being blackmailed. You understand? So then you're focusing on the intrinsic value of what you're trying to do rather than using some other factor. Yes? Thank you. I appreciate it. I haven't heard that, so I appreciate that. Yes?
I was just wondering, so this boy is learning just to get driver's ed, so you would say, let him not learn at all?
Not let him. He already isn't learning at all. You want to blackmail him to get him to learn in this way. If this is the only way you're going to get him to learn 100%, Lania's died for you. That's the worst thing you can do, because you'll teach him to hate.
What happens if he suddenly realizes, hey, this is not so bad?
Not under these circumstances. If that happens, it would be a nest nigla. No, not under those circumstances. If somehow he met a guy in shul, and some nice guy who took him for a walk and schmoozed with him a little bit, and, you know, made him feel happy and paid him some attention, and then say, you know what, well, maybe we'll learn for 10 minutes, you know, we'll have to do this, and he did it in the right way, then that would be a wonderful thing and possible. I've never seen it work this way, and I've been doing this for many years. Yes?
Isn't there a major difference between... called minor adult.
Yes.
Even though to do this, to make a change, I think because of the subject is with the whole point.
Right.
Whereas a child, I would give him as much candy as possible.
No, so first of all, a child doesn't
know. It's happiness for him. Yeah. It's happiness.
Let's say a child is neutral. Say you have a Rebbe, the kids like the Rebbe, everything is fine. The kid's playing ball in the, you want to get him back into the class. He doesn't have a time for learning yet. So yeah, about using these type of things as a way to, you know, to try. But then, as long as you're trying to make it geschmack and that you should enjoy it, you use that as a means. Because there's no negative at this point. It's pretty much neutral. Right? So then he can associate this, you know, the learning with something pleasant. But even here, the larger the prize, I'll tell you here, let me give you, they did a famous experiment in social and cognitive dissonance. It works like this. I asked you Takakash to see what Dylan thinks. You take two, let's say, this is what one of the experiments they did. Had a guy, he's taking a course in college. He goes over to one of his friends and says, listen, you've got to do me a favor. As part of my requirements to pass the course, I have to get somebody to give a speech, you know, pro-liberal or pro-conservative. It's whatever it is, it's the opposite of what the person is. His friend's a big conservative, he has to give a pro-liberal speech or vice versa. He says to him, listen, now, they set it up in different ways. In one group, they paid... And they tell, listen, somebody else was supposed to do it, and the last minute he backed out, I'll fail, I'll have to take another year to finish school, you got to do me a favor. I said, I should give a liberal speech, you're crazy, I'm the biggest conservative on the campus. I said, listen, yeah, you want me to fail? You got to. In one group, they paid the guy $55 to do it, and the other group, they gave him $50. They found that all these groups, it had an effect on the person's belief, to some degree. Which case do you think it would affect them more, when they pay $5 or $50? Yes?
I don't know.
Find out why, with alumnus. Because he had to explain it to himself. You're paying $50, I mean, my days in yeshiva, $50 a guy will do anything. You know, for a cigarette, a guy will walk for 20 miles. So, right? So, if you pay him enough, he doesn't have to convince himself that he really believes it. When the guy does it for $5, he has to think, what am I, a fryer? You know, I can do it, yeah.
So, you said that before you're taking the driver's ed,
by aggravating him and blackmailing your zichalusa.
Yeah, so what do
you do? You know, there's a famous thing from the Chazon Ish, was published in, I think, it's in the Maisa Ish, but they also published it in that special, the first special issue of the Jewish Observer, Kids at Risk, Maisa Shahaya, that there was a boy who went off the derech with a son, he was Chal Shabbos for Hesse, he asked his father for a car. quite amazing that they don't have having a car, but I guess the father must have been wealthy. The father said, I'll buy you the car on one condition. You don't drive this car on Shabbos. Didn't ask him not to drive any car. This car not on Shabbos. The kid didn't want. It caused further friction. The Chazanish sent them. It didn't even say that the father asked the Chazanish. It sounds like the Chazanish heard about it. And he sent them a message to ask you to buy him the car without any tonight. Because if you further undermine your relationship, that for sure you won't get anywhere. I told this to a fellow who was having difficulties with a son of his who was pre-risk, and he told me this is crazy, it has to be a Tosa Tfus. This is before the Jewish Shabbat, I showed it to him in the Maiseish. He told me it's Avada Tosa Tfus, it's Kenuzang, he happened to be going to Eretz Yisrael. He's a wealthy fellow, so he has a lot of money there, so he saw all the Gedolim there, and he came back more shocked than he left, because everybody told him that's Pasha Dezach, that's a Pasha, it's not a Kiddush.
Yeah. You just leave him alone?
Like, no, you try to build up the relationship so that you have what to work with. Because the Iker is all the Gedolim say, the Chazanish writes it many times, the Stipler writes it, that without a relationship you'll get nowhere. And if you fight with him, okay. Now, actually there's an unbelievable, this I just saw brought it this past Shabbos. I saw it in the Ramban and Shar Gemul, which I don't normally learn obviously, but there's a new print in it, so I was looking at it. And he says the Maisa, he talks about the Gan Eden, Gan Hednan there, and all these things. He writes that one of the people, the Gemara says, who don't get out of Gehenna too fast, included in the illustrious group of Rechavim ben Avot and Chaitu Machdias Acherim, among that group is the Parnas HaParnasim HaMatilim Eima Yisera Al-Atzibur Shalai L'Shem Shemai. The guy is a leader, and he uses intimidation and fear to get people to do things. And the Ramban says that even if he gets them to do the right thing, we're not talking about when he gets them to do the wrong thing, even if he's using his power of intimidation to get them to do what they're supposed to do. So I was shocked. Like, what is this guy doing with Rechavim ben Avot? Like, what was the case? He's not a Grace of Baal Musa. He should be a Grace of Baal Midas. What's his terror? See, the Ramban explains. He says, because they're serving the boss and not the Rebbeinu Shalaila. So when you use prizes or intimidation, all you're getting is the person is serving either the prize or fear, and the whole point of doing the chinuch is to get the person to be an Eved Hashem, and he's not going to be an Eved Hashem, he's being Eved in whoever's terrorizing. Yes?
Can you explain the skill method?
Of the sword and this and that? I talked to something, my son asked me that question, and I told him it's a good kasha, I don't know the answer, but I think, and I was going to ask somebody about that good convention where I was the other day, but you didn't get a chance to ask. So I'll tell you what I think the teretz is. I'm sorry? Because it says Shalei L'Shem Shemayim, the Ramban says. The Shalei, why? What's the difference of L'Shem Shemayim or not? Because somehow the person knows, like children know, when you're really doing it not for your own power, the children know. It's actually, I saw an unbelievable thing, it's B'dai Tavim Yisrael, from Rabbi Kirzner, Zecheinu Levracha. The Gemara says within Sanhedrin that, and the Rambam brings it down, that the one who gives the Malkis, the Shliach Bezim, gives the Malkis, has to be a chaser b'kayach and a yeser b'deya. Right? He has to be weak and he has to be smart. So b'shem the weak, we understand. We don't want to know if the guy, Moshe Rachman, is not the guy who's getting malchus. But it doesn't sound like a type of job that requires a special amount of chokhmah. Like, you know, it doesn't sound like that. There shouldn't be a requirement. You don't need an advanced degree. Like, what's up? Why do you have to be so smart? So the prisoner explains, because the person who's being hit, if the person has their own kavanah, if the person hits, who's hit, giving the malchus, thinks this is punishment, this is revenge, and doesn't understand that's for the taiva of the tshuva of the person, his kapara, so the person feels the difference. The person who's getting the malchus feels through the whip, he feels that what the kavana of the person is doing it. That's probably the teretz. And if you're doing it for pacta of the Shem Shemayim, and the Ramban says, this is when the Gemara says this one, it's not the Shem Shemayim. But the kasha makes it a good kasha. What if, I'm seeing, no, it says that he put a sword out and he said, like, whoever doesn't learn whatever this and that, so, you know, he'll be killed. There's a firmness that comes with, it's a nafmid if it's a shame shine. Why, how the child feels if that's a different shmuth? Okay, yes.
Doesn't want to learn at all,
especially
the kid maybe would have wanted to learn if he was in the wrong school with the wrong
rabbi,
etc.
It makes not feel bad. What I didn't hear the first thing you said.
Except this problem that it breaks down the relationship.
Oh, yeah, yes.
The kid
kid feels the parents are struggling. Let's say the kid maybe would have won or was led in the wrong school with the wrong revenue.
And you still do it that way by forcing him? You push it in chinuch. You have to always know what the effect of what you're doing. You have to know the child and know how he's likely to react. Sometimes it's a gray area; it's a little hard to know. So I heard once from a mashgiach, I was talking about kids who like overwhelmed with guilt and what it does to them. You know, he said guilt is not an inherent part of tshuva. If it makes the kid better, then it should be part of his tshuva. And if it not, you should forget it. You know, it depends what it does to him. You know, you have to know the child. You know, what my son's going to happen. Let me go. I want to go on, please. All right. Again, you know, there are studies that show there's a whole field of studies. It was published in a recent edition, a recent issue of the American Psychologist, about somebody who did a lot of work over many years on late theories, similar to what we were talking about before, discussing, you know, what the parent or the child or the patient's his own understanding of his problem. I always ask patients who come, what is your understanding of why you have this problem? Like I said before, usually they tell me it's because they're lazy. People usually have one of two general theories. One, believe it's an entity. This is the person's mitzvah, he's a lazy kid. And some people have what they call an incremental theory, where they understand that they believe that human attributes can develop and change incrementally through a person's efforts. Right? And how a person understands his own or other person's behavior, what it is that makes people behave the way they do, whether they believe it's changeable or not, will affect how they act to him. I found it very, and they say it's because he's lazy. Right? So I'll tell them, you know, see what you're telling me according to your, you know, your description of what went on, there could be other explanations. Maybe it's not because he's lazy. Maybe it's because the relationship wasn't good. Maybe because there was no shown bias. Maybe because maybe overreacted to his initial lack of enthusiasm for learning. And they say, nah, that's ridiculous. Don't give me those psychological baloney. He was always like, he was laughing from the day he was born. He was always lazy. I say, okay, so in Cain, so why are you so upset at him? He was born lazy, so what's the big time then? So they hold the rope from both ends. You know, when it comes to having kindness on him, Zichri could very easily not be lazy. But in order not for them to take any responsibility for it, he was lazy from the day he was born. So this has an effect. Similarly, another theory that people have that has a tremendous impact on how they deal with their children or talmidim is this. You know, we all know the famous the Ramban, the Rachaim, that a Baim Shem doesn't give a person an Nisayon unless he can overcome it. But this is a steer to the whole psychology. So why send the kid to therapy? What's the point? So let's say Taka has this problem and he was abused. And well, why not Kamina? It's an Nisayon. It's a Nisayon. He can overcome it. Right? Isn't that like, well, don't we all know that? Excuse me?
With the therapy, you can overcome it.
So the marshal I always give, because the patients themselves believe this, so they don't want to hear anything. Why should they go to therapy? They just have to work harder because it's an assignment. So I give them a marshal, this they can relate to. I said, imagine a guy wakes up, he has a migraine headache. It's time for Seder. So the Benjamin gave him an assignment, so he should go and learn in Seder as if he didn't have a headache. In other words, the Benjamin gave him an assignment. He's like, right, the Choshber, right, she asked him the Torah. Yeah. Okay, now it doesn't say he should be Yasid the Torah as if he didn't have the headache. Doesn't say that. He doesn't necessarily have to learn a tifa sugi in Yavamis. You know, maybe sit down and learn some of Bimagra Sayyid. Maybe that you can do. That is an Asayyid. Maybe an Asa Geichen. Listen, if he's in the Madrega, he can do it. Fine. But let's say it's not chance that he can't do that. Could be his Asayyid is like this. He has to go to sleep. But tomorrow morning when he wakes up and he doesn't have such a headache, he may tell himself, you know, I took off a day, I'll take off 3 days. You know, that could be his Asayyid. Or as Ramatashel Salman once did a tremendous chesed. He once sat with me together with parents who I was trying to convince, and they were claiming that everything I'm telling the kids about the courses. And he did me a type. He was unbelievable, willing to help. You know, anytime he can help. And he sat with me, and the father was very upset why the kid didn't learn. He stopped. He was working. He wasn't yeshiva anymore, and he wasn't learning. And I should tell him to go learn every day. I said, you've been telling him for years. It hasn't worked. He said, no, you will listen to because you he likes. I said, well, yeah, because I don't tell him these things. That's why he likes me. No, you know the psychological tricks to get him to do it. It doesn't work that way. Okay. So I tell him, listen, it's too hard for him to learn. He has too many negative associations. He tells him, no, it's a Nisayan, and any Nisayan you can overcome. So I'm at the sale to tell the father, sometimes a Nisayan is to realize that you can't do it. That's also a Nisayan. A little later on, the father started complaining that ever since the kid started coming to therapy, comes home and complains all the time. He claims he's being abused and mamish. And kept on saying, I can't take it. And Matisyahu turns to him with a big smile on his face. He says, What do you mean you can't take it? It's your Nisayan, so take it. Went right over his head, he missed it. Oh, another favorite belief that many people have that affect the relationship is the famous Chazal, Ein lecha davar ha'ima b'fnei ha'ratzon. Right? We all know that. When there's a will, there's a way. Nothing special. So if you want to do it, you can do it. So again, there's no excuses. What's the difference? What happened to you? Nothing stops you. So if you're not doing it, it must be proof that you don't want it. Right? That's the only possible explanation. Again, this rule seems to apply very selectively, because I had clear as yesterday, it happened quite a few years ago, this father who was telling me this line and explaining that there's no excuses for his son's behavior was about 100 pounds overweight and reeked of smoke. So I told the father, Mistana, you're happy that you're smoke and you're overweight. Father didn't tap what I was saying. He says, are you crazy? How much money I spent? For thousands of dollars. Try this, I try that. I said, Ein lecha davar ha'ima b'fnei ha'ratzon. But I guess the rule applies only to a certain age, or when you get married or have children. I don't know exactly how it works. Yes. Oh, okay. So, we'll explore later what this taka means. Actually, it's not even a chazal, but that's a different point. But you could understand that if somebody actually believes this literally, pashut pshat, then you could understand it would cause them not to have any sympathy for whatever struggle their child is having. Another popular belief is that children have to respect their parents regardless of how they are treated by their parents. And parents have no obligation toward their children. Many people believe this. Mamish, like Halacha Moshe Messina. Shem Shalfal Hirsch says that, you know, any parent who thinks his child will respect him, if he doesn't treat him with respect, has another thing coming, but not everybody agrees with this, it seems. I recently saw the new sefer that came out from Ramlucha Yehuda, the Darke Achayim. It's very interesting. He said this in front of a group of hundreds of Talmud Torah Bachrim, children, and he wrote in one sentence, Al hayadadim mutalas mitzvahs kivit avein, val hayrim mutalas hachayva loy lahachnis as hayadim lulachat, el hakol lasas bahava b'der chiva l'karv lovas, etc. It seems to be one goes with the other. Treat your child with respect, treat you with respect. But some people hold that the pasha can't hear the connection, has nothing to do with anything, you have a chiv, and of course that affects how, you know, as his parents asked me, my kid's such a chutzpahnik. I said, listen, after you just finished yelling at him and blasting him, like, what exactly did you expect? In fact, somebody once complained about me to Rav David Feinstein that I'm not telling the daughter to have respect for her mother. Mother was very abusive. So he asked, this person asked Rav David, is she taka putter from kibbut avet and kibbut ain't just because of chais? He's taka maskim that his sister taka tends to go overboard and do it. He didn't deny the fact. He said, well, I'm not kamina, still a chiyav. So ask her above, I need a psak, is there a chiyav or not a chiyav? So the David said, it doesn't really make enough kamina, it's not going to happen. So it's an academic question. If yad da chiyav, nishka chiyav, it ain't going to happen. If she's being treated that way, it isn't going to happen. Yeah. Okay. Now, again, there's another. We have to take a break here, right? Okay, just another minute. Yeah, I guess that some people again miss the point in it. I know there used to be a place I used to have a Mincha Meyer many years ago. And there was a fellow there. He always used to come with his kids, and he mamish used to embarrass them and insult them. And he was a very jolly guy. I don't think he had what he was doing, but he was always trying to. He must have heard once some mashgiach or something. You're supposed to show affection to your children. She was constantly patting them on the cheek after he insulted them and patting them on the back. And you can see that mamish got them sick. They used to when they were trying to talk to him, they tried to stay away from him. Right, so again, it's not of a lachutz. It has to be something that the child taka feels. And just to end up, just with an interesting side point, I think you'll find interesting, is that just to show you the impact of attitude on a person's behavior. They did a study. You know, the obesity is a big problem in America. So they did. They compared the attitude in France. You know, the French are very big into eating, but the rate of obesity there is much lower than America. So they wanted to say, what's taka? What's my high? So they found like interesting things that the French, you know, they eat slower, they eat smaller portions, they leave food over, which Americans don't do. I guess they marked it on Baltashkes. But one of the things that the interesting underlying idea, they did word association tests. They give a word and you have to say the first thing that comes to your mind. So when they told American women chocolate, their association was guilt. And the French, they say chocolate, they said celebration. Okay? So it affects how much you eat? All right, we'll take a break. Now, because of the attitudes and beliefs that we mentioned before, very often there's a tremendous amount of disappointment and criticism on the part of the parents toward the children. And I think probably one of the most painful feelings that a child can feel is feeling that he's a disappointment to his parents. I don't think you can compare anything else that happens to a child to that feeling. I had this experience a few times. It happened recently. I was sitting at a chasna next to somebody who was about shoes. He asked me what I do. Okay, he told me you're a psychologist. They want a free consult. So he tells me like this. He tells me, you know, I'm very disappointed in my child. He learns, he's in, I think his first year of Smedrish or last year of Sifta, learns out of town. Stark not happy. So, well, what's the matter? Says he comes home and on his off Shabbos once in 5-6 weeks, doesn't open a sefer over the weekend. I said, really? So when in Yitzhaka not learning a word in yeshiva? No, Chas v'Shalom, a kid. I spoke to the Rosh Yeshiva and to the Mashgiach, and he's shtaking, he's learning it, leila, leila. So he says, what's the problem? No, Alec Walker comes on the weekend, doesn't open a sefer. I'm stark disappointed. So I told him, listen to what you're saying. We have a bacher, he's stuck at tachshit, he's stuck at learning, and he's steiging with the bomb, anything he would want. And he probably is learning too much, like in Heintek Yeshiva, he says there's no benefit door, and there's no such thing, you got to stay up to 2 o'clock in the morning, otherwise you'll never get married, you won't get a shidduch, there's all kinds of things in Yonim. Right? So the Mela, the guy is like burning himself out. So Baruch Hashem, they give him a break once in a while, and he's able to relax over the weekends, and Shemam Shmi is stuck to feeding. So, and he's walking, this bacher is walking around that he's, his father's stuck disappointed in him. He says he doesn't stand a chance. I said, I'll give you my card, you can call me when it finally hits the fan. Oh, now, what does this do to, when a child feels that his parents are disappointed in him, obviously has a tremendous detrimental effect on his self-esteem. It's especially difficult for a child because, you may have heard the expression of the Stockholm Syndrome. Anybody hear about the Stockholm Syndrome? Okay, so the Stockholm Syndrome originally came about, I think it was in the 70s, that there was a bank robber that held up a bank in Stockholm, in Sweden. And he held a hostages for a while. One lady particularly, he held her for a few days. And in the meantime, she fell in love with him. She wanted to marry him, I don't know. And they found in other cases with hijacking, the famous case of Patty Hearst you may have heard of. And there's other cases where people who were held hostage for a long period of time identified with the hijackers. They talk to good people, and it's not their fault. I care, it's the Ayum's fault because they don't listen to them. Their voice is not heard. So, where does it come from? Because when somebody is totally dependent on somebody who has shown that they could, this bank robber had shot somebody in cold blood. So when you're totally dependent on somebody who's shown that they could be very cruel, what would you rather believe? Would you rather believe that this is really a very good person who is really the fault of the victim because they chepit him, mechais, or that he's a mean person who could kill you in cold blood? What would you rather believe? What is less frightening? Certainly less frightening to believe that he's really a good person. If you really behave well, he won't do anything to you. It's called the Stockholm Syndrome. This has been applied to children who are abused. What would they rather believe? That they don't really deserve to be abused and their parents are abusing them anyway? Or that there's something wrong with them and it's their fault they're being abused? And almost all children will pick the latter over the prior. And they would rather blame themselves. In fact, recently, this has actually happened this week, I was speaking to a father. There was a young man I was seeing who used to be a super goody-goody-goody for all the unhealthy reasons, and lately he was developing serious emotional problems. And his father was mamish a dictator, and was actually quite verbally abusive even to the wife, caused shalom bayis problems. But the father, to his credit, is an ish emes, and when the son, I helped the son be assertive and explain how he's suffering and what's going on, he was talking meidal emes, and he told the child he apologized, but he himself was very shook up when he realized what he did to his child. This, of course, happens to 1 in 100 or, you know, less. So he asked to see me. The son agreed. I got his permission to meet his father, and he came to Brochen. The mamish, he realized, you know, what he did, and his mamish doesn't know what to do with himself. So he tells me I shouldn't think that he's avzer, some such term. I told him, listen, on the contrary, you should know, mamish, I'm telling you the honest truth, that I have developed your respect for you. The fact that you could, in such a situation, be meidal emes, if anything, I have very high esteem for you. If I can't. Second of all, so every child wants to have a relationship with his parents, so if you talk to continue with what you're doing, things will be okay. And third of all, I told him, I imagine you probably had the same experience with your parents, you know, that's why I went like that. He goes, I had it worse. He starts giving me a whole litany of what he went through with his parents. The Teichat Devarim, when he was describing what he went through, he tells me, the Lamaisa, I love them very, very dearly. I told him, oh, that's the problem. Why is that a problem? I said, because if you believe that you could abuse your children and they'll love you dearly like you do your parents, and you can do the same thing to your child. I mean, of course, you have frakum tishitas, this is what you, you know, this is what you're supposed to do with the chais, but you don't have to worry about the repercussions because, after all, it's not a stira. You could be abusive and be loved anyway, so there's no big downside. I said, if you would tell me that you've learned to accept your parents, or you've learned to appreciate them for the good things that they did for you, even though, you know, in this area, technically, weren't good, or you learned to understand them, where they came from, you make peace with it, that's a mature, that's like a, something you have to get to. But to love them very, very dearly, you know, when they speak to women who are abused by their husbands, and they talk about how much they love their husband, that's part of the problem. So then you pass it on. I said, you know, then it goes on to the next door. But that comes from the Stockholm Syndrome. That's what we said before, because when you're very dependent, the thought of thinking that you rather think that you deserve it. You know? And even though, and it's a little deceiving, because sometimes a child will complain to you and tell you that mom is your father, you know, complain about his father. But the mice said doesn't mean he doesn't think he deserves it. Because sometimes you can come back from your dentist and complain to your friend how much your dentist hurt you. Doesn't mean you go beat up your dentist, because you feel it's necessary. So the child very often will blame himself. Sometimes I'll tell the child who says it, I say, it sounds like your father's being abusive to you. He says, oh, Sean, abusive? What are you talking about? I say, describe how he beat you up. He says, yeah, well, of course, I didn't do my homework. Of course. Now, another factor that's especially important to teachers, I think, because it really affects a kid's cognitive abilities, and again, what I just said before, is that since most children who have these problems are not able to articulate, they're not permitted to, or they're too scared to articulate the stiras that they see, the contradictions, it actually affects the ability to think clearly. You know, I've heard very often when you go to conferences about kids at risk, very often they'll tell you, you know why the kids go off to Dera? Because they see stiras by their, they see these, you know, they see by the inconsistencies by their parents. I usually make a macha and I say, listen, if you have to be consistent to have do a decent job in raising your kids, then we're all in deep trouble. Because I don't know too many people are consistent. I said, the problem is that while they're not consistent, they demand consistency for their child. That's the height of inconsistency. That's the inconsistency. I said, you know, how many kids who were learning well but didn't get up so much on time for davening were told by their father that what's your learning worth if you don't get up on time for davening? And then when you see inconsistencies by your father who says this, and that's already a stira.
No,
yeah.
Right, like, but they don't mean it like what's really worth.
I want to ask you something. And if a child would say something chutzpahdik and he'd say he doesn't mean it, would that work? That's what you have to be consistent about. I never saw that terrorist work for a child. You have to be responsible for what you say. You know, it's a silly thing to say. Yes.
Well, we can respond. It's just logic involved, and that would work. Now there's no better chutzpah.
Many children have been taught that saying, you know, protesting the illogical nature of what they're told is also called chutzpah. I'll tell you a maestro that I heard once, I saw in a sefer, very interesting sefer, it was called Chinuch B'Darkei Aviseinu, where he quotes one of the, I think, the Mashgiach in Kamenitz, the maestro that he heard from Rav Elie Lapian about himself. And tell me how many kids you know who could have said what he said. Revelio, when he said that when he was 7 years old, he once his mother had left a cup near the edge of the table. He walked by and knocked it down. So his mother reprimanded him for being careless where he walked. The next day, he left a cup at the edge of the table. His mother knocked it down. She reprimanded him for being careless, you know, where he left his cup. He told his mother, wait a second, I can't be wrong both times. It's a stira minei obey. Either the person who puts it at the edge of the table is responsible, or the person who knocks it down. I can't be responsible both times. Doesn't say what his mother told him, but I guess he couldn't have been too bad, or he wouldn't have had the guts to say it. Maybe that's why he grew up to be a very clear thinker. But most kids would be totally intimidated, and they'd have to somehow accommodate this in their brain, that they happen to be wrong both times. How exactly are they wrong both times? Lakasha Humaisa, from Lakasha Stockmanish, as they say. You shouldn't. The child at least should know. He can go through the story, but the child should feel comfortable to protest. And if the parent has a shtickle at this, he should say, you're right, in the Chanami. And the Rosh Hashiva who, when they were asked the Kasha, didn't have a teretz, who called the Gemara, and they said, okay, that's under the Shia, I don't have a teretz. If you say it that way, it doesn't have to be chutzah. If you ask the Kasha, you say, wait a second, how could I be wrong both times? It has to be chutzah? No, forget about that thing, but if it's not in learning, like Revelio said that he said, that's called chutzah. But he's supposed to walk around and feel this is true. If you say, listen, you said something stupid, that would be chutzah. But if you ask the Kasha, how could it be? Okay. Okay, now, part of the problem also is that very often parents are incredibly oblivious to the fact that they're being critical. Recently, the father who complained, who told me it bothers him tremendously why he has such a distant relationship from his son. His mom said, no relationship. I said, well, perhaps this is the same one who always criticized his son for how he didn't do well in school and told him that it was because he didn't care. I said to him, listen, you know, probably the reason is when you criticize him for so many years, it's not such a big kasha why you don't have a close relationship. So I said, what? I was critical? You know, I always used to tell him, if only you put your mind to it and you weren't so lazy, you could go to medical school. I was very supportive. This guy was honest. I'm telling you, I wasn't critical. I was very supportive. I told him you could go to medical school. If only you weren't so lazy. Took a while, but I was able to explain to him that thus hates criticism. Right? Similarly, somebody told me, this mamash happened today. My father was telling me, he called, I've seen his son. His son gave me permission to speak to his father. So he called an eitzah what to do. He felt very. Lately, his taka been trying very hard to be there for his son, do things for him. His taka, you know, to his credit, has been working hard at it. But recently, he asked his son to do something, and the son didn't do it for him. Wouldn't do it for him. He asked him a favor, and the son wouldn't do it. So he felt like very hurt. He's doing so much for his son. His son didn't do anything for him. So he wanted an eitzah. How could he tell his son how to? How could he tell it to his son? I gave him an eitzah what to do. He says, "No, but I want him to be clear that I'm not asking for reciprocity." I said, "You are asking for reciprocity. Let's call a spade a spade. You have to reciprocate. You know, you did him a. He wants. He's a good father. He's doing the taivas without any covenant to get anything in return, right?" I said, "Well, let's be honest. That isn't you're calling because you didn't reciprocate. That is exactly the problem. Maybe you're right. Maybe you have a right to ask for such a thing. It was agnish. But at least be honest with what you're doing. And this is amazing. He's calling me up to complain that his son didn't reciprocate, but he wants to know how to give over the message that he doesn't expect him to reciprocate. Be honest about what you're doing." Now, sometimes besides the general theories of humanity that people sometimes have, sometimes they have individuals, that tailor-made theories that are constructed in order to take the father off the hook, the parent off the hook, and get the child on the hook. Recently, a guy told me, the same father that I was mentioning before, who wants to know why he had a distant relation, so he told me he has an explanation. He says he doesn't agree with me that the reason why the child is distant from him is because he criticized him, although he's masking that he did, but that's not the reason. What's the reason? Like this. Because, really, until he was a teenager, they had a pretty decent relationship. He probably doesn't realize that most kids have to pretend they have a decent relationship until they're a little bit more independent. As Revolver says in his paper on Pinna, talks about that. You can't tell how things are working while the kid is young, because he doesn't mention the Stockholm Syndrome, but it's that idea. He said, well, what happened when he became a teenager, when he got into high school, he went to a new school, and this parents, they're middle class, and in his class, his friends that he made in his new class happened to come from wealthy families, and therefore, even though I always tried to teach him, the right values, for some reason he got enamored by the idea of being rich, and therefore, now that he has rich friends, now he's embarrassed of his father who's not rich. And that's the whole problem, because he has no values. So this was his theory, and of course this affected his whole relationship with his son. Now, of course, again, if a child internalizes the way his parents see him, if they see him in a negative way, it affects his self-esteem, his confidence, his ability to be assertive, and his religious identification. As Rabbi Kirzner writes in his book, if you ever saw the book he published about Tefillah, the Jewish art of prayer, or something like that, it was punished in the introduction, he writes that the parents are the ambassadors of the Rebbeinu Shalom. Kids don't meet the Rebbeinu Shalom in person, and the Rebbeinu Shalom is represented by their parents. And if the parents are harsh, critical, capricious, then that's how they see the Rebbeinu Shalom. And many of the kids' problems are the kids who supposedly have issues with hashkafa. And I like that when they refer to me, a 14-year-old, and says he has issues with hashkafa, with emunah. So it's funny, the Rambam didn't worry about this till he was 15. This kid at 14, that's what he's worried about. But as one writer, I wrote in one of my articles, I quoted somebody who wrote that children express their issues with their parents through God. Okay, so now we're getting to therapy. So what happens in therapy? A kid comes to therapy. Very often people give sociological explanations for psychological phenomena. They say, you know why he has problems? Because of bad friends, influence of bad friends. That was interesting. Why, from all the kids in the school, this one is the one that got attracted to the bad friends. What made him vulnerable to the bad friends. It's usually psychological reasons. It's like when they say, you know why a guy's violent? Because of poverty. There's many people who are poor who are law-abiding citizens. What? That's not a sufficient explanation. In fact, one of the most moving stories I ever heard of parents who are sensitive to the impact of what's going on to avoid making the child vulnerable. I read the story, some editor of a magazine, I don't remember where it was quite a few years ago, wrote a story, a true story that happened with his mother. And when he was growing up, they were very poor. They lived in a tiny apartment above a store. And parents were always worrying about money. You know, how are we going to pay this bill? How are we going to pay this bill? And every once in a while, when things were really tight, his mother would say to her husband that, look, if we really have to, we'll take out money out of the account. That's it. We need to. That's what we'll do. We'll take the money out of the account. So years later, when the mother retired, was moving to Florida, he told he mentioned to his mother, maybe it's a good idea to close the account in the bank here and move it to a bank in Florida. The mother starts laughing. She says, a bank? Who has accounts in the bank? And whoever had money to put in the bank? She says, my whole life, I always heard about this bank, this account in the bank. The mother says, listen, we didn't have any money in the bank. We knew that you always heard us worrying about money. We knew it would make you feel insecure. So I made up this account so you shouldn't be so insecure, so you shouldn't worry so much about it. Thus haste. And it's that sensitivity to what environment you're creating for a child. Okay, now a kid comes to therapy. What is it? So first thing you have to know is that therapy takes time. There's no miracle. There's no miracles. It doesn't happen overnight. I remember once, many years ago, I used to treat young children, and I don't anymore, so I once treated a child for bedwetting. I cured him in one session. How I did, I have no idea. to my shock, the pediatrician was telling all the mothers that I know this guy, he can treat bedwetting, he can cure it in one session. I called him up with the whole of pleas. I was getting a million phone calls. I don't cure it in one session. It was a fluke. I don't know how it happened. So usually these things don't happen. Of course, there was one patient told me once, he says he realizes now that therapy is a process, not an event. Okay. Now, under pressure from the managed care companies, they would like to make it that you can cure somebody in one session, but it really doesn't happen. Just like there's no miracle diets, but somehow since people like to believe it, you know, every month the ladies' magazines come out with a new miracle diet, eat whatever you want and lose 50 pounds a week. You know, and people, since I'm a kid, I've seen it and seen people believe it. Most people who come to therapy suffer from poor self-esteem. They're very, very sensitive to how other people perceive them. In fact, usually they put all their energy into what I call other esteem. They don't even try to get self-esteem because they don't think that that's the problem. They're constantly trying to impress other people, which does absolutely nothing for self-esteem, even if you manage to pull it off, because it has nothing to do with the self. Right? And they're usually very self-critical, and therefore they're very hesitant to be open, because anything they say about themselves, they're certainly going to be judged for. So that's one of the first things in therapy, try to get the person to be comfortable, to be open. Usually the predominant emotion of many people who come to therapy is shame. There's a famous author, you may have heard of him, he writes some very books, John Bradshaw. He wrote a book called The Healing, the Shame that Binds You. He's actually one of the few people who write the psychology books for the lay public who actually writes very, very well. And I just want to quote a few sentences from what he writes. He writes, toxic shame is experienced as the all-pervasive sense that I am flawed and defective as a human being. It is no longer an emotion that signals our limits, which is really what Chazal mean when they say busha. You know, one of the characteristics of Yidden is that they're baishanim, which is usually interpreted as shame. The busha, I saw, I think, either from Simplicissa or from Reuven, I forget, that really with Chazal, when they say busha, they mean guilt, not shame. It's not a shame about yourself, it's guilt over what you do, which is healthy. That's what he means here. It's not a limit. A person has a certain self-respect, so there's certain things he won't do. It's not what we're talking about. It is a state of being, a core identity. Toxic shame gives you a sense of worthlessness, the feeling of being isolated, empty, and alone. A shame-based person will guard against exposing his inner self to others, but more significantly, he will guard against exposing himself to himself. I would say this describes really what goes on in therapy, trying to get somebody behind that, past that. Very often, because people are very self-critical, they don't want to tell you things that their weaknesses, they don't want to talk about their weaknesses, which of course, what's the point of going to therapy if you're not going to talk about it, but the mice, it's very difficult for them. Let me just shut this. So for instance, there was a young man I was seeing who he was big troubles at home, and the way he tried to compensate for it was by being the perfect person. He was a perfect child. When it was Rebbeim who originally referred him, he said he was a poster boy for whatever particular yeshiva he came from. He was perfect in learning and in sports and in popularity and whatever you can think of. And his goal in life was he was going to be the biggest Talmid Chacham in the world, the best lawyer in the world, and some third thing which I don't remember at the moment. At some point, he was not able to sustain this. And the straw that broke the camel's back is when one of the Rebbeim in his mind respected another Bacher more than him. And that was like the end of it. The whole package unraveled. So then he went to another yeshiva with less pressure, and I was trying to help him get on his feet and just be a normal person, not have to be the best person in the world. Actually, my Matisyo Salman said once, somebody asked him, if you help a child develop self-confidence, aren't you making him a Balgaiva? He said a Gavaltig answer, Mamash Gainis. He said this Mamash Punktfakert. Exactly the opposite. Self-confidence means you feel that you could do it as well as the average person, and that's good enough. A Balgaiva has to do it better than everybody else, and it's difficult to be confident about that. So he had this problem because being a normal person wasn't enough. But he was getting somewhere. So one day he comes in, he says, Baruch Hashem, this week was actually pretty good. I got to yeshiva, I learned, I was doing, I was functioning. Went pretty well. But then he gives a crest. So the Lamaise, he says, the laziness always gets you. Really, what happened? He says, the marshal yesterday I had 2 hours I put aside, I was supposed to study, and instead of studying, I played an electronic game for 2 hours. So really, what time of day was this? He said, 10 o'clock at night. I said, what were we doing the rest of the day? Oh, no, I was in yeshiva 7:30 for davening, and I learned well, and I was in shir, and I wrote notes, and then I studied for a test, and the chais was, and then finally at 9 o'clock I finished, and I had to wait for my ride a half an hour, so I sat and learned for half an hour, then I got home at 10 o'clock, I was planning to study for a test for 2 hours, and lamaisa I didn't, and pushed laziness. So I told him, you are epitomizing what I call snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. You've heard the expression, snatching victory from the jaws of defeat? A lot of people who come to therapy are expert in snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Right? Here, the guy put in 14 hours in the yeshiva, now Mishtaka doing what he's supposed to be doing, and because after 14 hours he needed a break, the pashat he's lazy. It's this type of thinking that you have to counteract in therapy to try to help a person learn to think in a healthier way. Very important. Now, of course, in order for somebody to open up in therapy, especially somebody who has a lot of these shame issues, you have to make him comfortable, and he has to feel safe. It has to be a safe haven where he can be open with himself and others. Yes.
How does a person feel good about himself, or confident, or not snatching the defeat
and the jaws of victory
when he has these responsibilities and he doesn't fulfill those responsibilities?
Which responsibility are you talking about?
Studying for the test.
Again, if he told me he had a whole day and he wasted the whole day, he didn't learn a word the whole day or study, kind of hashtag. It's after you put in 14 hours to call that laziness. I mean, there's actually the guy who says, I think it's a pasuk in Mishnah, he says, "Vivelis adam tesalav darkei v'al Hashem yizaf liboy." You know, just because you make up a stupid plan and you throw in a kapitel tilling for good measure and it doesn't work, don't have time to under Rabbi Yishalom. You know, thinking that you're going to study for 16 hours or learn for 16 hours, not much of a plan.
He's not lazy, he's something else.
Yeah, he's overambitious because he's perfectionistic and he feels he's only a worthwhile human being as if he can do, if he's not human. No. Now, that's why confidentiality is very important. The reason why, a patient could sometimes be more open than a therapist, even than he would be, let's say, with a Rebbe, even a Rebbe that he likes a lot. That's really why there's a need for cooperation between the teachers and the Rebbeim and therapists, because each one serves a different function. The therapist's role is limited because he only sees the child for an hour a week. Somebody many years ago who dealt with troubled children, I think his name was David Wyman, he wrote a book called The Other 23 Hours. It's very good he's in therapy for an hour. This was a place, was a treatment center where they have therapy every day. Because it's another 23 hours, you have to deal with what goes on. Now, the teachers and the Rebbeim, of course, see the Talmidim much more than the therapist. So each one has a mile and a chesaron. Very often the kid originally feels more comfortable with the Rebbe or a teacher that he has shaykhs with, that he sees all the time. But the chesaron is, because he sees them all the time, sometimes they're much more embarrassed to say certain things because they have to face them. therapist is somewhere in a corner somewhere that you only see once in a while, they sometimes feel more comfortable. It's also many schools that have in-house therapists, which is in many ways a big bracha, it's very helpful in many ways, but again, have this chesaron, because there's certain things that a kid won't tell an in-house therapist that he'll tell somebody, a therapist who's not involved in the school. Yes? Well, that again, because that's the issue of confidentiality. First of all, a Rebbe usually can't promise a child the same degree of confidentiality that a therapist could, especially to an older kid. However, I've had many cases where Rebbe promised the kid, the teachers promised the kid that they won't tell something to the parents, and they did, and that's why I'm just crying. I've had kids that got burned that could never trust the Rebbe again. It took me like sometimes 3 years. There's one guy I'm seeing for 5 years. I told him he still doesn't trust that I'm not telling his parents anything, even though his parents really don't like me very much, because I stirred up a hornet's nest there. But you know, nonetheless, he says he knows it's not true, but he can't really be totally confident that I'm not telling everything to his parents.
Well, that's what his brother supposed to do, but if a kid tells him all his personal things, what is he supposed to do? What action can he take?
So, well, one is obviously lending an ear, and if it's something serious, then obviously trying to convince him to go see a therapist. That's very often, sometimes, when you have a Rebbe who backs up. See, very often say, a kid, I have that right now, today, some patient, a teenager called me and said he's not coming to therapy anymore. I know, but he probably had a bad day, you know, and he feels the therapy isn't helping him. But he's very close to his manal, you know, and when he told me I can call him, and I can call him, leave a message or now for him to call back. He obviously wanted me to talk to the manal, and the manal, of course, knew about it, right? He spoke. He said, don't worry, I'll speak to him, you know, put things back on track. So we work as a team. You know, when he has tainas on them now, I convince him to be open with it. I said, look, he's a nice guy. He's always treated you with respect. If you have tainas on them, he's not going to bite your neck off. But then, and the manal supports the therapy.
So what helping hand can the
Rebbe do? Sometimes it's limited. If it's a problem that's beyond the scope of what, you know, he can handle just by talking to the kids, so then the Chanami has to send them for more professional help. Now, one of the important roles of therapy is to understand the meaning of the behavior. Understand what is it that the child is expressing by what he's doing. Not just saying symptoms, he has this mishigas. You know, it's never a mishigas. When you really understand what is happening with a kid, the kid can be doing the craziest thing in the world. There's a fellow once who was an incredible therapist. He used to work with psychotic people. People, you know, had mamish totally off the wall. And he said, and he would spend hours with them and hours and trying to understand them. He wrote an unbelievable book. It's out of print already. And he writes, that, you know, he never worked with somebody. If he gave it enough time, it'd make perfect sense once you understood what went on in the person's life. But usually people don't ask. Let me give you some short examples just to bring you an illustration. I don't want to run out of time. A guy comes in. Of course, I'm giving you only a short vignette, so it's a little bit out of context. So I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but I want you to see what I'm talking about. This, I think, even a Rebbe or a teacher can do, just to understand what happened. So this fellow comes to me. He's very frightened. He had a lot of difficulties in his life. He was pressured as a child to always do well in school. Now he's having trouble functioning because he's on his own. But he comes in one day very frustrated. He's very upset at himself. He's lazy. Why? Because he has an overdue phone bill. And it already has, you know, an overdue charge. And he's not paying it. He doesn't know why. He has money. He has a check. He has money in the bank. He has the bill. He has to do his mail it. He doesn't understand why he's not doing it. Every day he says he's going to do it. He doesn't do it. Right? And he's afraid the punchers are going to cut off his phone service soon. Now again, does this make sense that because this guy works every day. He works, you know, whatever, 5 hours a day, whatever. Does it make sense that laziness? I mean, somebody's too lazy to send a check in the mail. I mean, it doesn't make sense. That's the reason. So I got him to introspect a little bit what he feels like when he's sitting down when he thinks of writing out the check to pay the bill. And this is what it was. He's very self-critical. And because he was irresponsible by not originally sending it out on time, so when he has to sit down and face the fact in black and white that he has to pay extra money for this charge, he can't. People are very self-critical, will hurt themselves tremendously just to avoid having to deal with reality, even though then, of course, they have to pay for it. And even though it sounds to us crazy, we're all guilty of that. You know, if you have a skin irritation, you scratch it, you know you're not really exposed to it, it's only going to make it worse, but you can't resist because you feel the need to scratch. When there's a feeling, you know, somebody who can't tolerate self-criticism because their self-esteem is low, is weakened, so this is what they do. He just couldn't tolerate the idea of actually sitting there, and I walked him through. We spent the whole session talking about dealing with the feeling of writing the check. He came back the next time, Baruch Hashem, he wrote it. Another one, here. A bacher, a beskadrish bacher, in his family, he's considered a layutzlach. You know, they're always having tangas on him. He feels like he's a black sheep in the family. But the one area of expertise, he's very good at getting deals. On the internet, phone deals, cellular deals. You know, he's a macher in these inyanim. So Tetepsi has a shtuk called Ma'amad in his family. He's the expert in these things. So his brother comes over to him one day and says, listen, you know, I have a problem with my bill with the cellular consult company, whatever. I have to, you know, they owe me money. They don't want to give it to me. Can you take care of it? He says, yes. Every day he says yes, he never takes care of it. His brother's really getting very angry at him. Of course, I ask him, so why do you think you're not doing it? He says, because I'm lazy. Which, of course, is ridiculous. He would spend hours on the phone doing these things. Like, what all of a sudden became lazy? What's that kind of shot? Because even though he doesn't mind spending time deals, he's very unassertive, and he can't tolerate the idea that somebody's upset at him. So it's one thing to go find the best deal on the internet, but to actually argue with a company to get a refund that he can't do. But he's not also assertive enough to tell his brother that he can't do it, that he should do it himself. So he keeps on saying every day he's going to do it, and then Lamaisi doesn't do it. Let me tell you a more deeper thing that's more serious. I once saw a guy, I was in Eretz Yisrael at the time, I was working in Eretz Yisrael. I saw a fella whose one of his close friends got killed in the army in action. And he never was able to get over it. It wasn't even his closest friend, Grada, but it was somebody he went to yeshiva with, and he never got over it. Like he never overcame the mourning, and he had all kinds of fears. Fears of what if somebody in his family dies, and it really became a serious problem. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what's the problem? First of all, it wasn't a very close friend. It was somebody who was in his class. The whole thing didn't seem to make too much sense. It took a lot. He wasn't a very open kid. He was very close. His family, people didn't talk about feelings, so it was very difficult to get him. But finally, this is what came out. When he was a young kid, he had a lot of feminine quality. He had a squeaky voice and plays his hand motions. A lot of kids make fun of him like he's like a girl. That was like an issue. So now when his friend got killed, you know, he was very shaken up, and he got very emotional, and in his own mind being emotional is a girly thing to do, you know, so that's girlish. And the mom stared at him. It was a tremendous, the whole, you know, the fact that, so when he thought about somebody in his family getting killed, he wasn't fearful of the loss of somebody in his family. It was because he doesn't know if he wants to control his emotions. This was Mamisha trend. Whenever he told me, he used to think about what he's going to say by the hesped for his father. So again, I thought all kinds of other problems were, you know, some other more traditional of meaning. But that wasn't his problem. He went off, he felt to control himself, control his emotions while he's speaking. It was a whole different passion. You know, it took a lot of work to figure out what exactly the problem was. Now, another thing that we have to do in therapy is to help a person understand that it's a legitimate explanation. As if a person went through a very difficult life and was abused or whatever else happened to them, that is a legitimate explanation for why things are more difficult for him than it might be for other people. That's not a double pusher by people. Somebody told me right now I think it was even today, that he learned in Eretz Yisrael, more modern school, and Mashgiach, I don't know how it came up, but it somehow came up in conversation. One of the Bachrim said that, you know, they were talking about the intermarriage, a high rate of intermarriage, and somebody said, listen, some of his friends who intermarried were abused both at home and in yeshiva that he went to, the school he went to. And what do you want from them? You ever said, no such thing, you got to get over it. You have to take responsibility. I know some of the adults don't have to take responsibility, the kids do. I don't know exactly how it works, but you know, that doesn't mean if a guy had a rough life, he should throw in the towel and not pull himself together and try to make... I told somebody once, I said, listen, just because, you know, somebody messed up the first part of your life, there's no reason to, you know, to have to continue this. If we can figure out some way to help you to get on your feet, it's kedai to do. But since people believe that it's really not an excuse, because they believe that Ein Lecha Dovra Ayma B'Fnei HaRotzen is a literal translation... So I want to just explain what ataka means. Matzisil Salman in the cipher of Matnas Chaim, I think it's Amud Yudalit in the first chaylik that came out. Yuches says there that he brings out Hashem based on the chayvus avodas. He doesn't actually bring out this statement, which happens not to be a chazal. Somebody in Bar Park a few years ago put out a kuntrist of all the supposedly mamar chazal that are not mamar chazal. There's popular saying. Or Musa Swarm sometimes say to bring out a point, but it happens, it's not a chazal. But the meaning of this idea, based on the Chayos Alvavas, means that there's nothing that can stop you from having a Ratzon. And you get schar for having the Ratzon. There are many things that can stop you from bringing your Ratzon to fruition. In fact, if you really think about it, believing it in its literal translation is a shtickel apikorsis. If I want something, the Baishu can't stop me. You know, it's amazing that people actually say this stuff and believe it. It's ridiculous, of course. The Baishu can have different plans. Right? But nobody can stop me from having that. The Baishu allows in each person. That's his bechir, that he can have the Ratzon for whatever he wants. If a person is sincere about his Ratzon, so then he gets hard for the Ratzon. Well, that would, that's Zichanar Chazal, that's Benjamin Franklin, I think. But it's hard, doesn't mean, because it says, Ein lecha davar ha'oymed bifnei ha'ratzon. There's nothing that stands in the literal translation, there's nothing that stands in the way of the ratzon, and that's taka the job. Nothing can stop the ratzon. When there's a will, there's a way, it's taka apikursus. Not true, you can have a will, the ratzon doesn't give you the way. But Ein lecha davar bifnei ha'ratzon, that is not the literal translation of Ein lecha davar bifnei ha'ratzon. Nothing can stop the will, and that's taka in the chanami. Another thing that many people have a difficulty with, when you try to give somebody a psychological explanation for a problem behavior, people say, "No, and what happened with the Yetzirah?" Okay, say, "Pashut, what do we have to have an explanation for it?" Say, "Yetzirah." So, you know, I tell them like this. Let's say if you met a guy that sometimes is nichshol in lashon hara, let's talk it. Because I know Yetzirah. What's the Yetzirah? You don't need therapy for that. You have to learn Shmiras Lashon. Let's say you met a guy that didn't speak like the guy mamish yemim v'layla speaks lashon hara. He's knocking this guy, knocking that guy. Is that likely to be the problem? They didn't learn enough Shmiras Lashon? Now, that's clearly a psychological problem, that he obviously has low self-esteem, and the only way he can deal with it is by knocking other people. So first you have to get him to the madrig of being a normal Baal Aveira, and then he can learn in the Musar. One bacher once told me, he had issues, certain issues with Yetzer Hara. So after he was in therapy for a while, he says, you know, now I'm in trouble, because what I used to have to do, now I only want to do. So I told him, for that they have Musar Svar. Yeah, before he had to do it, now he only wants to do it. Nope. So welcome to the human race. Okay, now after understanding where the problem comes from and trying to improve the self-esteem, because understanding where the problem comes from the reason why it's important to understand the past is because if you understand where the problem comes from, you're less likely, it has a less of a negative effect on your self-esteem. If a person is not able to function normally, and he has no explanation for it, so that is, you know, he just thinks he's crazy. Once a person understands where it comes from, it's more likely to, you know, won't be so harmful to self-esteem.
And then I'll wake up a can of worms.
By?
In the past. Hey, is it always that?
And if you do surgery and not opening up a can of worms, depends how big the problem is.
Sometimes, you're right.
Hanami. You have to make a judgment. You don't do surgery unless it's some good reason. So, you know, if everything is going more or less...
Everything has to be... Every problem you have to go through...
The shayush?
You know, make
depends how big... Depends how big the problem is. If it's a minor problem, very often the kid doesn't come to therapy. If you have a good Rebbe and who understands the kid and gives him proper adjust and physics, it's very often set up.
That's the only way to answer the question.
If the problem is big enough and the person is very down on himself and because he's not doing what he's supposed to or doing what he's not supposed to, then it's very hard to, unless the person can understand, first of all, it's very hard to help him if you don't understand what the problem is. It could be like the examples I gave before. If you don't know exactly what the problem is, it's hard to know what you're working on. You know, and it's very often, I think that very frequently it is necessary. It's hard to say in every specific case, but, you know. Now, somebody many years ago wrote that therapy is like, he called it a corrective emotional experience. Some people had tainus on it at the time, but it's very important for people to realize, especially for rebbeim and teachers, that being nice to a child is very often not enough. You know, being nice to a child is often not enough to change the past. You know, I thought of a good mashal once. I had this on my own experience. When I got my first car, I didn't really understand the chashivas of changing, you know, the putting in oil. I thought it was like an optional thing. I know people, you guys are maybe too young, but at one time you had to change, you know, every time you filled with gas, they checked your oil because they weren't so hermetically sealed as they are today. You know, your mom had to put in oil all the time. I didn't know this, you say, so the kids are... I burned out my engine. I managed to get my car into the station. I had no idea what's going on. I tell you, what's wrong? Check. Listen, you burned down the engine. I said, why? What happened? You didn't put oil. I said, you know what? Put in the best oil, fill it up with oil. He says, no, it's too late. You burned out the engine. You have to strip the engine right now, which is quite expensive. So what shot? You know, if I would have put in oil, I wouldn't have the problems. Because if a child's self-esteem was dealt with properly all along, you don't have the problem. Once it was destroyed or demolished, being kind to Kan Laba doesn't do the trick. It doesn't undo the damage. I remember there was one fella who learned in Eretz Yisrael by a certain well-known Menahel, who was a Bachar Mam Shlav. I've heard from many Bachar. He's an Adam Yakir Ma'id. Unbelievable. So he was telling me how the whole world hates him. I told him, what do you mean? The Rebbe had an Eretz Yisrael sound that he didn't hate you. He said, yeah, he's such a tzaddik, he would love anybody. Because it didn't prove anything. He just showed what it did. If a guy liked him, it just proves what a tzaddik he was. He even likes Rishayim. But it didn't have nothing to do with him. Right? You have to undo the damage, which usually, unfortunately, takes a long time. Very often, the first thing you have to deal with is many kids who need help feel shame over the fact that they need help. That is mamish. And very often, parents mamish tell the kid that, you know, it's like needing a crutch. For some reason, needing a crutch is a dirty word. I'm not sure exactly why. It's like the worst thing that can happen. I know, you know, kids tell me, I don't want a crutch. I said, well, if you broke your leg, wouldn't you use a crutch? I'm like, what's it to be a baby? If you need a crutch, but I don't use a crutch? They have a very hard time accepting, because they were made to feel, again, because they were made to feel that there's something horribly wrong about them, the fact that they need help, that's why a lot of kids won't take tutors. I'm sure teachers have this experience where a kid clearly needs a tutor, and the kid refuses. Why does he refuse to have a tutor? Because the fact that he needs help, that he's having difficulty, is a very shameful thing. You know, sometimes parents, when they come and talk about a kid, they present the problem, and I tell them, you know, he clearly needs therapy. He says, he'll never go. I said, yeah, I know he'll never go, because you've always told him that's all his fault, because he's lazy and doesn't care. So maybe if you change it too, maybe after a few months he'd be willing to go. Yes?
Psychological or
sociological?
People view the kid
and
say, oh, he's the kid that needs help.
Again, it's true that, you know, when people talk about stigma, it's true there is such a thing in the world as stigma. But again, I contend that what the kid learns at home is much more powerful than anything he learns in school. I think if you grew up at home, and when something goes wrong, and you get help, it's fakir, it shows that you're a good person, it shows fakir, you know, how to handle situations. I think that such a person will have a much... Because usually the real stigma is, like, kids go to therapy for years and nobody ever finds out. Now, I've had kids tell me, no, I don't want to be the only one in my school, you know, who's in therapy. I happen to know that like a quarter of his class is in therapy. You know, he doesn't know about it. So the same way they didn't know that. It's an internalized stigma. The biggest stigma is what a person thinks. When parents tell me, I don't think the kid should go to therapy because there'll be a stigma. Is that how he feels about himself? I'll tell you, my Sushai is like a public amount. I think one of the most brilliant statements I ever heard said on a date. The person I was seeing, his parents were divorced. He was very self-conscious about it. Went out with this girl, and after a few dates, he asked the girl, so how do you feel about the fact that my parents are divorced? So she answered him, how you feel about it is probably a lot more important than how I feel about it. I told the guy, you should marry her just for that statement. Now, no, Chas v'Shalom, never. Of course not. A lot of things you can't say, although it would be helpful if you could. No, never say anything like that. No, it makes a kid self-conscious. Very often in therapy, one of the big... Yes? They're usually still...
Sure.
Sometimes, unfortunately, you know, it has to get worse before it gets better. Sometimes... Even with the kid himself, sometimes when a kid doesn't want to go, I tell the parents to be patient. You know, it doesn't hurt. It's like people won't go to the dentist until it really hurts.
Is he found there's certain kind of worry that you maybe can't get, like, turn them
more sometimes, you know, yeah.
What if parents think it's a financial reason why they can't get their kids help?
It's with too lengthy to answer the question. Obviously, there's different things that you try, but if they claim it's a financial reason, it's, you know, it's the same thing I tell the parents when they claim the reason why they won't buy the kid the clothes he wants because it's too expensive. I usually ask him, if he was getting straight A's, would you buy him the clothes? Usually the answer is yes. I said, at least be honest, don't take clothes, it's too expensive because you don't like him enough to buy him the clothes. That's a legitimate reason. So there are A's. The big chaylims that will pay parts of it. I'll tell you, in my experience, I'm sure there's not a rule that applies all the time, but in my experience, the ones who make the biggest tumult about the money are the wealthiest people. I've had people, mamish, had to borrow and beg it from their relatives and this, and fakir, when I tell them maybe you should come less frequently,
make it a little easier. If he needs it, don't worry, I'll take care of it. You know. And the other ones, make the kid feel guilty that they're spending money. It's a pellet. The father is shelling out big bucks to send the kid to therapy, and he gives them two. These are two favorite messages sometimes during it. A, you really think the therapist likes you? He's only doing it for the money. And that's accomplished times. Yeah, because they feel competitive. You know, if he likes me more than them or something, you know, they feel threatened by it. And second of all, they tell them, you know, how much is this costing me? And the ones who don't have money hardly ever say that. I'm not saying there are cases where, Porsche, there is no money. But, you know, but listen, what do you do if you don't have money for Skylimut? You know, I'm just saying, there are such problems. But I'm saying 90% of the time, that's really not the problem. Okay, now...
Question.
Yes.
What's the difference between a social worker and a...
I'll speak about that in a minute. One second. I just want to say, just the one that could, that the main thing of therapy is to build self-esteem, not other esteem. To get the person off trying to impress other people and trying to impress themselves, because that really builds the person. The difference between the difference, just a fact, the difference between the different professions that deal with therapy, there's a long history to these things, but in today's day and age, psychiatrists usually give medication. Very don't give medication, and social workers usually have less training than psychologists, because most of them have master's degrees, not doctorates. Many of them have had training post. Now, many of them have been trained. Some are very well trained in clinical work, but it depends on their particular.
I'm asking this because, like, I have a student who's gone to social work for almost a year, and I see very little improvement. I'm wondering if it's directly different to see psychologists.
It's a very touchy subject. So not something I'll discuss in public. Okay, so I guess we've been, all right, thank you very much, everybody.